From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Today, we revisit a conversation about Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, the six-lane street that loops around downtown Baltimore. Does it reflect the values Dr. King represented? We asked two transportation experts. Then, on July 4th, 1861, 4 months into his presidency, Abraham Lincoln sent Congress a speech that foreshadowed his address at Gettysburg. We discuss it with Washington College historian Adam Goodhart. Plus, it's a strong statement to call someone Machiavellian. In a recent biography, Johns Hopkins professor Christopher Chalenza tells us why Machiavelli's ideas have such staying power. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast, and this is a man named Lonnie.
Right now, we're on Martin Luther King Boulevard, McCullough Street. We just got a two-lane street on both sides going up and down. It's grass growing in the middle. Is it a store spot because it belonged to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? God rest his soul. And like every time I cross this street, like I just think about the man that he was and try to be like the man that he is.
You might drive down Baltimore's Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard every day and, unless traffic is snarled up, not give it much thought. Last January, on the holiday to celebrate Martin Luther King Jr., we took a look at the Baltimore Boulevard that bears his name. With me to talk about how the boulevard came to be and how it unites and divides the city was Celeste Chavis, an assistant professor in the Transportation and Urban Infrastructure Studies Department in the Morgan State University School of Engineering. And we were joined by Gerald Neely, a former transportation planner in the Baltimore City Department of Planning. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard was opened to traffic a generation ago in late 1982. While it was being constructed, it was known as Harbor City Boulevard, but its name was changed by the General Assembly to honor Dr. King. It is very wide, six through lanes, plus left turn lanes, and in some spots, right turn lanes. I began by asking Gerald Neely what was there before MLK Boulevard.
A big condemned swath was there for quite a few years. It was originally supposed to be a full-fledged expressway, so they condemned a whole lot more than they really needed, and then they put in a surface boulevard to fill the void.
But it was essentially a residential area, or was there a street there?
Yes, there were small streets there. Fremont Avenue to the south, Myrtle Street in the north-south section, and then Biddle Street in the part up by McCullough.
And what was the thinking behind the boulevard?
They had condemned it for an expressway back when Baltimore was considering this, you know, huge, full-fledged, comprehensive expressway system. And then piece by piece, that expressway system got killed, and it left all this vacant land in its void. So you can think of Martin Luther King Boulevard as sort of an expressway light.
Moving cars is basically the philosophy behind it. Professor Chavis, how does a broad boulevard like MLK affect the communities around it?
Well, I think the MLK Boulevard is kind of serving as a bisector between West Baltimore and the downtown area, simply because of how fast the cars are moving and the volume of cars. Uh-huh. So it makes it pretty difficult for anybody using a different mode, such as pedestrians, to go between them. So essentially, it cuts the two communities. And that bridge is kind of broken.
And how does that affect the communities, do you think?
I think it affects particularly the West Baltimore community because it's not seeing the same growth that we've been seeing in the downtown area. And so it becomes, you basically have to kind of revitalize the two communities separately since there's not really that interconnection between the two due to the fast-moving vehicles.
Gerald Neely, you're nodding your head. You agree?
I agree completely. I would just add that the sheer width of the road is a major factor. It isn't just the volume of traffic, it's how far you have to go in order to walk across the road and how long you have to wait for the traffic lights to change.
So it's not that there are not places to cross, it's just that you have to wait a long time.
Yes, there are also, especially in the northern section, there aren't enough places to cross as well. Between McCullough and Pennsylvania Avenue, it's a very long stretch without a crossing. That creates these big border vacuums between the communities and downtown, as Celeste just said.
Professor Chavis, as you said, it divides downtown from West Baltimore. How could it be redeveloped, in your view, to fit better into the city around it?
Well, one of the interesting things I think about the quarter is it is so wide. So there is a lot of land that could kind of be repurposed in a way. You have the really large median, and from what I believe also on the side of the road, like the sidewalk space is pretty wide. So it does allow engineers, planners some flexibility when it comes to redesigning the corridor. So some things that have been done is trying to have more of what's called a complete street. And what that means is you're trying to design the street for more than just the car. So you're designing the street for all users who would be on it, whether they're pedestrians, in their car, in transit vehicles, et cetera. And that's kind of like the new mindset of planners and engineers today, is to try to design for the throughput of everyone and not just the throughput of cars.
On Maryland Morning WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. I spoke in January about Martin Luther King Boulevard with Celeste Chavis, an assistant professor of Transportation and Urban Infrastructure Studies at Morgan State School of Engineering. Also with us was Gerald Neely, a former Baltimore City transportation planner. Gerald Neely, you've written about this in the Baltimore Brew, possibilities of redeveloping the boulevard, but it's still, even as Professor Chavis described, going to be a broad stretch from one side of the boulevard to another. How does that actually connect the city more?
Yeah, I think the traffic is going to stay there. I don't think there's much you can do about that. And I think that narrowing it down is probably the best way to provide some relief. You know, it's always going to be difficult.
Narrowing it down by getting rid of the median, narrowing it down by getting rid of lanes of traffic.
Yeah, just as she said, there's a lot of you know, extra space. You could definitely narrow down the median, which is just dead space. And then the right turn lanes aren't used very much. The left turn lanes, which is where you have to wait for the traffic in the opposite direction, those lanes are very well used. But the right turn lanes, which are pretty much free flow, some of them are really, you know, overly free flow. We could get rid of those.
But if you narrow it down, then you're not going to move the buildings closer together that are now on either side. So what does that streamlined land become?
There's a lot of empty space. There's a lot of still leftover parcels from when the original expressway plan was devised, and they're just sort of, they made them into parkland, but it doesn't really relate to anything else. You know, it's green space, but it doesn't belong to anybody. It's not a people place. That's basically what you need, is to convert it into something that's a people place.
And how would you do that?
And that requires good design. The parkland from block to block needs to relate to the other blocks, make it more of a linear park where you, say you would jog along the whole length or ride your bike along the whole length in the parkland.
Professor Chavis, do you think MLK Boulevard would be built today?
Yes, probably.
Really?
I just think it's such an important connector between Baltimore and D.C. for people who are leaving the D.C. area and coming into Baltimore, that it probably would be built differently, but there would be some major road letting off of the 395 highway, allowing vehicles into the downtown and northern areas of the city.
And do you envision that Baltimore would be stuck with this divide you've talked about between downtown and West Baltimore?
I think it would be done in a much smarter way today than what it was done prior to. So there would still definitely be a major corridor for vehicles. Probably would have been a bit smaller, maybe not as many lanes, depending on how the planning was done. But it is a vital link, I believe, for the city.
The traffic on Martin Luther King Boulevard may divide people. It also attracts some people. For panhandlers, it can be a resource. Here's James, who told us he's homeless.
I've been on the street roughly a year now. I come up here to Martin Luther King, you know, every day just about, and I try to, you know, make ends meet, whatever I can get. You know, people help me out, give me a dollar or two here or there. And, you know, some people, it's surprising. You would think more people would help you. But, you know, some people, they got it messed up out here so bad that people don't want to help you anymore, you know?
Gerald Neely, in your view, does MLK Boulevard reflect the values that Dr. King stood for, like civil rights and economic equality?
Well, it's a physical barrier, much more than a racial barrier, I think. I think it is what it is. It's just this huge wide thing with huge amounts of traffic going back and forth. And that is, in my mind at least, separate from the racial issues in Baltimore. There are lots of other barriers and streets and things in Baltimore that are more racial barriers. Sometimes it's both physical and racial. For example, West Baltimore Street, west of Martin Luther King Boulevard, is much more white south of Baltimore Street than it is north of Baltimore Street. That constitutes more of a racial barrier with all the sociological issues. Martin Luther King Boulevard, in a way, is actually an easier problem to solve because it's a physical problem. It's just designing the streetscape in order to fulfill people's needs, you know, which is easier than actually, getting into the content of people's character, as Martin Luther King did.
Professor Chavis, how do you think this boulevard connects or doesn't connect to Dr. King's legacy?
From the transportation standpoint, a lot has kind of moved towards making sure that we design for everyone. So making sure the person who doesn't have a car has the same access as someone who does have a car. So these major streets like MLK kind of show kind of the work that we still need to do in our field, where we do need to make sure that we invest evenly. So we're not just investing in cars, or we're not just investing in transit for those who are working downtown. So in a very micro scale, it kind of does show what work still needs to be done, I think, for the city.
I appreciate your thoughts. Thank you. Thank you both.
Good answer.
Thank you.
Celeste Chavis is an assistant professor in the Transportation and Urban Infrastructure Studies Department in the Morgan State University School of Engineering. Gerald Neely is a former Baltimore City transportation planner. We've got links to his thoughts on redeveloping MLK Boulevard in the online news site The Baltimore Brew at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. There's more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay tuned to 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. On July 4th, 1861, just 4 months after President Lincoln was inaugurated, just 3 months after the first action of the Civil War at Fort Sumter in South Carolina, the president sent a message to Congress. He walked through his version of what had happened in the previous few months. Quote, "So viewing the issue," Lincoln wrote, quote, "no choice was left but to call out the war power of the government, and so to resist force employed for its destruction by force for its preservation," end quote. Afterward, Congress voted to increase funding and troops for the war by 25%. Adam Goodhart is a Washington College historian and author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. When we spoke in the spring of 2011, I asked him to set the scene of the first summer of Lincoln's presidency.
Talking about people's expectations of Lincoln at the beginning of the Civil War, at the beginning of his presidency, I think it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that they were very, very low. Lincoln had come from greater obscurity to the presidency than really any man who had ever assumed that office before. He was a one-term congressman from Illinois, really a failed congressman from Illinois. And he hadn't even set foot in Washington, D.C. in 12 years when he got to the White House. So people didn't know what to expect. He stepped into a federal government that then, as now, or perhaps even more than now, was dominated very much by a coterie of insiders, of party insiders, of congressional insiders. And here was this outsider, and he was a bit sort of physically and personally awkward. And it's interesting, after the war, his own secretaries, John Hay and John Nicolay, who were great admirers of Lincoln, said that no one at that time thought that Mr. Lincoln would be the chief man of his own administration, and least of all, Mr. Lincoln himself.
Oh, really?
That's right.
He himself didn't view himself that way.
That's right. Yeah, it's clear to us when we look back at him, and that's one of the things that interests me about looking at this moment in history, the very beginning of the Civil War, is that Lincoln is not the sort of great, omnipotent, all-knowing leader that we think of today. He was somebody who was really sort of bumbling and stumbling his way through the early weeks and months of the secession crisis.
And he really hadn't campaigned. It was unseemly for
the
candidate to campaign or to vote for himself, you write. And then even as the secession started, he didn't make it clear what his vision was. And after the surrender of Fort Sumter on April 13, 1861, and then the Pratt Street riot in Baltimore a week later, what was Lincoln spending his time on? What was the president doing?
Well, you know, everybody, of course, well, for one thing, from the moment that Lincoln was nominated the year before, everybody had been waiting for Lincoln's sort of great statement on this crisis. First, the crisis that was hanging over everyone's heads, and then the crisis that very quickly became reality at the end of 1860 as these states, these southern states, one by one seceded. And he had said very little. He came to Washington. He gave his first inaugural address that was, although we think of it today as a very eloquent document, there are some beautiful passages in it. In fact, the mystic chords of memory, the better angels of our nature. We think of it as this eloquent document, but it actually was very confusing at the time. It said different things to different constituencies and was very unclear to most people. So after the surrender of Fort Sumter, after the beginning of hostilities of the Civil War, Lincoln still hadn't made his sort of great statement as to what this cause was that he was asking the North to fight for. But he began working on this statement very, very quickly after the surrender of Sumter at the end of April and mid to late April of 1861. And he spent really the next 2 months laboring over this document that he intended to present to Congress on July 4th, 1861. He had called a special emergency session of Congress for July 4th. And by mid-June, he was working just about full time on this document. People were very puzzled. Even those who knew Lincoln well thought it was very strange that with a war quickly unfolding in America, the president should be holed up writing draft after draft after draft of this document.
And why do you think he did?
Well, I think that Lincoln understood at that moment that in writing this document, this message to Congress, he was really doing essential intellectual work, the essential intellectual work of the war in a way that was going to prepare him and prepare the country to fight. You know, even today, we have a hard time, and historians argue about the causes of the Civil War, about what the North was really fighting for. And I think that Lincoln recognized at the time that that cause might be hard to articulate, and he decided to sit down and articulate it to make it perfectly clear to himself and to other Americans what it was that they were going to war for.
That's Adam Goodhart, journalist and historian, here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, 1861, The Civil War Awakening, specifically the last chapter, Lincoln's Independence Day Message to Congress. In some ways, you write, this presages the Gettysburg Address.
It does. There's you know, this message to Congress, this July 4th, 1861 message, is not typically read as one of Lincoln's great masterpieces. But I think while the prose is not always as soaring as in his inaugural addresses, as in the Gettysburg Address, that intellectually, this is one of Lincoln's greatest, perhaps even his greatest achievement. He even uses in it, you can feel that sort of the rough draft of the Gettysburg Address in some ways. He talks about the Civil War, and he says, "This issue," meaning the war, "embraces more than the fate of these United States. It presents to the whole family of man the question whether a constitutional republic or a democracy, a government of the people, by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity." And so here we have an echo or a foreshadowing of this government of the people, by the people, for the people. He's working those ideas out, and he's really arrived there more than 2 years earlier. He's recognized that this war is not simply about keeping certain parts of America, certain states within the Union. It's about whether democracy can even work in practice, or really as a theory. He recognizes, and he explains to his fellow Americans, that in a very real way, secession is the same as anarchy.
Yeah, he says, you say, that he says the very existence of the Southern Confederacy was not only a threat, but a crime.
Exactly. It's a crime because when you think about democracy, the idea of majority rule and minority concession to that rule are at the very root of what democracy is. And if you have a situation where people who are outvoted simply say, well, in that case, we're going to withdraw from the compact, go off and do our own thing, I think it's easy to understand why you would have anarchy very, very quickly. If you're ever in a situation where people who don't like the rules can simply withdraw, you have anarchy. It's sort of the same as if, I get pulled over speeding, the officer says you were doing 75 in a 55 mile an hour zone, and I say to him, well, I think that the speed limit should be 75, and so I'm going to just keep driving and rip up this ticket and throw it out the window. It's sort of the same abrogation of a social contract by denying governmental authority, and Lincoln recognized that.
The editors of the Baltimore Sun, which you describe then as, quote, unbending in its defense of slaveholder rights, close quote, they took issue with one paragraph in particular, and let me ask you to read the first sentence of that.
Sure. "This is essentially a people's contest. On the one side of the Union, it is a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. Yielding to partial and temporary departures from necessity, this is the leading object of the government for whose existence we contend."
The Baltimore Sun said he's clearly calling for abolition, but abolitionists said he didn't talk enough about slavery.
Exactly. You know, it's more than 6,000 words, this message to Congress of 1861. So it's about 20 times as long, 20 or 30 times as long as the Gettysburg Address, a very long document. But he doesn't even mention the word slavery once. He doesn't mention the issue of slavery once. He's talking entirely about secession in sort of the abstract, rebellion in the abstract, freedom in the abstract. But here he says something that's thoroughly new in American political life. When he says that the object of government is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, and then finally, especially, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. There he's saying something new. He's not simply saying all men are created equal. He's saying that government has to play a role in maintaining some of that spirit of equality. He's saying that government has to make sure that there are not artificial constraints that are placed upon each of us. And especially that last phrase rankled on many people reading between the lines when he says that government has to afford to all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. It's that phrase is interesting in so many ways. One thing that struck me reading it is when he talks about the race of life, he's using the language of Charles Darwin. He's using the language of this new theory of evolution that has all these different species and creatures competing against one another, jockeying for a position in the world. But he also uses this term, an unfettered start. And actually, when you think about it, unfettered start is a little bit of an odd metaphor. Going back and looking at Lincoln's rough draft, he originally said an even start in the race of life, which makes more sense from the point of language. People in a race get an even start, but then he changed it to unfettered, which suggests that he's thinking on some level about slavery. And interestingly, it was his opponents, his critics, who picked up on that very quickly in 1861. And those of his supporters who were more pro-abolition, like Frederick Douglass, for instance, didn't pick up on that and were disappointed at the message.
Adam Goodhart. He's director of the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College in Chestertown. His book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening. We have a link to a transcript of Lincoln's speech at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also, a link to Goodhart's cover essay in April's National Geographic, tracing the route of Abraham Lincoln's funeral train from Washington to Baltimore and on to Lincoln's home in Springfield, Illinois. You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. July 4th weekend is upon us. You may be planning a cookout or going to a cookout or thinking about a cookout. Great, but we'd like to help you expand your options a bit. We've put together a few events taking place this weekend across Maryland. Tom's here to help us tell you about them.
Hey, Sheila, of course, there's no better way to celebrate our country's independence than by staring at burning powder streaking across the summer sky. The big fireworks extravaganza in Baltimore is at the Inner Harbor at 9:30. Festivities begin at 7 with a performance by the United States Navy Band Cruisers. They're at the Inner Harbor Amphitheater. That's at the corner of Pratt and Light. And you and about 100,000 of your closest personal friends can, of course, catch the fireworks from there. You can also have a good vantage point in Federal Hill, Fells Point, Harbor East, or a well-placed roof, and you'll be happy to know we will not be providing a list of well-placed roofs on our website.
Not yours. Some of you may be escaping to the coast this weekend. Ocean City's got you covered on the fireworks front as well. Their July 4th celebration will kick off with a free concert at 8 at the North Division Street Beach. Bring a blanket or chair to sit on while you catch the fireworks at 9:30. And if you're looking for something to do during the day, in Baltimore County, Dundalk's famous Heritage Parade gets underway at 8:15 a.m. at Logan Village Shopping Center near Dundalk Road.
In downtown Frederick, the July 4th festivities at Baker Park begin at noon with a reading of the preamble to the Declaration of Independence. There will be musical performances throughout the day, lots of food, games for the kids, and to top it off, fireworks shoot off at dusk.
Of course, Washington, D.C. has a slew of celebrations this weekend as well. The Mark's Pen Line will run on its normal Saturday schedule. Fares recently bumped up a bit. A ticket from Penn Station to Union Station will now run you $8. Once you're there, the National Independence Day Parade will kick off at 11:45 and will run along Constitution Avenue between 7th and 17th Streets. Marching bands from across the country will be there, along with equestrian and drill teams.
And on the U.S. Capitol's West Lawn, a free 90-minute performance by the National Symphony Orchestra will include Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, complete with live cannon fire. Let's hope they get the cannon in tune this year. That's at 8 o'clock. Fireworks on the National Mall usually start shortly after 9 o'clock. And, of course, we'll have links with more information about all of the July 4th happenings on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, ahead on Maryland Morning, how Machiavelli's ideas still resonate today. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're addicted to the deceitful dealings of Frank Underwood and House of Cards, could be you're really addicted to Niccolò Machiavelli and don't know it. 500 years after Machiavelli wrote his masterpiece, The Prince, his name is synonymous with cunning, expediency, and bad faith. But a recent history of Machiavelli and his times says there's more to the Renaissance diplomat and writer than the unscrupulous label we fixed on him. The book is called Machiavelli, A Portrait. Last March, we spoke with its author, Christopher Chilenza. He chairs the Classics Department at Johns Hopkins University. I began the conversation by asking why we should pay attention to Machiavelli in the 21st century.
You know, I think the model that he set was most important. What many people don't know is that before he wrote most of his most famous works, he was an active politician and diplomat. He went on over 40 diplomatic missions for the city of Florence, his home, from 1498 to 1512. And I think for him, it's that ambition to serve his city, which was most important to me, that ambition to be involved, that was what he always wanted to do. Even after he started writing, he always wanted to get back into politics, to get back into the game. And I think that model of service is something that, especially among young people today, they seem to want to do it, but they seem not to know how to channel it. So in some, I would say, unexpected ways, Machiavelli can be seen as a model of service.
That is not what most people think
about
Machiavelli.
That is absolutely not what most people think about him.
Most people think of the And I know, as I understand, he never said end justifies the means, but that's kind of the summary that people give these days to his thought, and the idea is that it's self-serving.
That's true. Well, there's a part of The Prince where he says he's going to talk about what he calls in Italian the effective truth of the thing. He says the verità effettuale. Sometimes we call it the concrete truth of the matter. So in a sense, he did want to see results. And it, unlike many intellectuals who tend sometimes, as you know, to imagine worlds that don't really exist and hope that we can somehow meet them, he instead had A, real-world experience of dealing with politics and violence, and B, this other side of reading history, of reading lots of ancient history. So he combined those two experiences, the present and the ancient past, to come up with this model, this aspirational model.
How did he come to write The Prince? What was going on in his life at that point?
Well, Machiavelli, after these years of service from 1498 to 1512 to the Florentine government, there was a change of regime, and the famous family, the Medici, came back into power. They had been out of power since 1494. Upon them coming into power, Machiavelli's name was discovered on a list of possible conspirators against this new regime. He probably had no idea that his name was even placed on this list, but somebody had put his name on this list. His name was discovered. He was arrested. Because he lived in a pre-modern world where there was no habeas corpus, there were no individual rights, he was tortured, and he was put in jail. And after one of the Medici was elected pope, Giovanni de' Medici was elected pope as Leo X in March of 1513, a general amnesty was declared. In that amnesty, Machiavelli was released from jail, but he was sentenced to remain largely within Florentine territory. His family had a house on the outskirts of Florence, and so he went there. It was a kind of a farmhouse, and that's when he really started to write the works that he's known for today, The Prince very much included. In fact, The Prince was the first major work that he wrote while he was there.
And why did he write it? What was he trying to accomplish?
Oh, the theories about that are innumerable. My own belief, and I think that a lot of people would agree with me, is that he wanted to find some way to get back into government. And now that the Medici were back in power, as he was shaping this treatise, he eventually wanted to look at it almost as a kind of job application. That's probably the most, on the surface level, that's probably the most true. On a deeper level, I think he really did want to distill what he had learned from his own practice of politics, because he gives us vignettes, you know, that of things he himself experienced when he was a diplomat. combined with this new way of reading very, very ancient history to focus only on the realistic, only on what worked, only on the sorts of examples that mattered for everyday life now in politics. And that's what I think makes him so exciting, somebody who combines a vivid appreciation of the present with this really fascinating take on the ancient past.
Here on Maryland Morning, WIPR, that's Christopher Chalenza, professor of classics and of romance languages at Johns Hopkins. I'm Sheila Cast. We spoke last March about his book, Machiavelli, A Portrait.
Machiavelli was fluent in Latin, as I gather all educated people in Italy were in the 15th and 16th centuries. But he wrote The Prince and a lot of other things in Tuscan.
Yes.
Why?
He was part of a new revolutionary generation of writers in Italy who had been part of a kind of a cultural experiment in the 15th century, the century before he was writing, where they studied ancient Latin so intensively that they discovered a set of rules that gave it a kind of seriousness that they hoped all literature could be able to have. Once those rules were discovered, there was this new generation, and Machiavelli really is in some senses the first, to try to write Tuscan in precisely that way. And indeed, when you read Machiavelli, everything is more or less written in Tuscan, but it's often surprising to readers that the chapter titles of The Prince are in Latin. He's willing to quote long phrases from ancient Latin writers that he's studying in Latin. A lot of times when you read translations of The Prince, obviously, everything's translated into English, as it should be. But when you really get down to it, in some ways, it was, I think, a dialogue for him between Tuscan and Latin.
He did not publish The Prince.
That's right. He did not. He did not seek to have it print published. And I think that's another fascinating thing that makes him much closer to us today than we might otherwise imagine. In some senses, you could say he did publish it in the most literal sense of making it public, but he made it public to the public who mattered most to him. And this was this circle of advisors. We know all of these names from the many letters that he wrote contemporaneously. So he makes it public to them. And these are people who can maybe approach a cardinal in the Vatican to see if there is a job for Niccolò Machiavelli, or maybe approach somebody in the Florentine government to see if there's a place for him. So he did, in a sense, make it public, but he didn't seek to have it print published. And that's a real difference.
You're saying it's social media.
I honestly think that there are, given the media revolution we're undergoing now, it makes it a lot easier to understand what Renaissance people were up to when they were publishing, because it was just more variegated and diverse and more local. And that's the most important thing, is how local it was.
So you said this might have been, on his part, a job application. It's hard for me to see how the ruthless ideas that show up often in The Prince would have been reassuring to someone who had some doubts about whether to trust this guy.
Yes.
How did it work out for him? What happened to Machiavelli after this?
Well, Machiavelli, in fits and starts, does re-enter public life in a very small degree. Eventually this period of this very loose form of house arrest ends. He's able to go back in Florence. By about 1520, he's able to talk to the Medici again. He has an audience, for example, with a cardinal, Giulio de' Medici, who will eventually become Pope Clement afterwards. And he is given a contract by the University of Florence, which is part of the city of Florence, i.e. the government of Florence, to write the history of Florence. He's sent on a few more diplomatic missions, but he never attains the heights that he had during his key period of service from 1498 to 1512. So in a sense, there's a kind of a melancholy aspect to Machiavelli, because you can just tell, especially if you read the many letters he wrote, all he really wanted to do is get back into service. I think he would have thrown all of his writing away if he could have just gotten back into service.
A sad note on which to end. It's a really interesting book. Thank you.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Christopher Chalenza chairs the Classics Department at Johns Hopkins and also teaches history and romance languages. His book is Machiavelli, A Portrait. We spoke in March. Got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Mary Wiltenberg,
Christy Forrest,
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow is July 4th. On that day in Maryland history, 1815, the cornerstone was laid for the Washington Monument in Baltimore. It was completed 14 years later. We're back Monday. Hope you'll join us.